Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhouseonline.com.au.
Well, tonight we come to the final instalment in our absorbing, ambitious sweep through the entire Bible with part 8 of our Spectator's Guide to the Bible. Over the past couple of months, each Sunday night here on Open House, John Dixon has been taking us through it all, step by step, from a few points of view, historical, because this is history, theological, because it's the story of God in this world, and it's been personal, because I think the wonderful thing about this grand sweeping narrative is that it's played out in the lives of real people, in all the highs and lows of the human condition. John, for the final time in this great series, welcome. It's great to see you.
Thank you.
Thank you. So and because it's our final segment tonight, you've got a chance to ask John anything you want. If it's still not all quite hanging together, if there are specific questions you've got, historical, theological, especially personal, give us a call from anywhere around Australia or, for that matter, overseas, because I know you're there on 1300 40 2020 or post on our Open House Community Facebook page. I reckon John Dixon is one of the most engaging voices for the Christian faith in our culture. He's got a PhD in New Testament history. He's a lovely bloke to talk with. There's a wrap for you. 1300, he's blushing. 1300 40 20 20, or have your say on our Facebook page. John, when we see how the Bible, I think, comes to its crowning climax tonight, it's probably worth briefly going back to the very start of our journey, I think, and make that connection between the beginning and the end, if you like, the Alpha and Omega.
Well, that is the thing to do, isn't it? Because yeah, the Bible is one story. It has a beginning, has an end, and it actually wraps up incredibly beautifully. It really is the story of God's creation moving to a new creation. And so the opening sections of the Bible tell us that Adam was in relationship with God, in relationship with Eve, and in good relationship with the physical earth itself. So at the very front of the Bible, you have these three relationships in harmony, perfection with God, with one another, and with the earth. If you like, Genesis 2, which describes this, is kind of like the model of a perfect heart that a cardiologist might show to a patient in order to show what is meant to be, in order to describe the problem. And then Genesis 3 describes the problem. Adam disobeys God. And as a result of that, these three dimensions of our existence come unstuck. Adam's relationship with God unravels, relationship with Eve unravels, and relationship with the physical earth begins to be frustrated. Now, the importance of this is the rest of the Bible is about God restoring all three dimensions. Yeah. It isn't just about God restoring our relationship with Him, though that is central. It's also about God wanting to restore our relationships with each other, and He wants to restore the physical creation itself. So the whole story of the Bible through Israel right into the New Testament is this threefold story. And you think about the Israel story, they're brought into relationship with God, they're made into a great nation with each other, but they're also given a land. This is the sort of environmental dimension of the Bible's promise. Yeah. And that promise too comes to fulfillment in what the New Testament says about the future. And this is why the final two chapters of the Bible, Revelation 21, 22, are full of references to Genesis 1 and 2. It's because these are kind of like the bookend ideas of the whole Bible. God is moving us to restore the three dimensions. And so in Revelation 21, we hear about God creating a new heaven and a new earth. Now, I think most people think, hang on, I thought it was just heaven. But no, the Bible ends with a new earth, which echoes Genesis 1. And then you get references to the tree of life and the rivers and all this in Revelation 21, 22, because it's saying the whole story is about God redeeming not just the social, not just the spiritual, but also the physical.
So you're saying when it's all wrapped up, there's this clearly defined entity of this new creation. So our picture of the afterlife is probably more Hollywood-driven. We're up there in cloudland, cloud surfing, playing harps. There's a defined new creation.
Well, that's what the Bible says. I mean, I think for some of us, our view of the so-called afterlife comes from this sort of weird combination of Greek philosophy and Hollywood movies, because the Greek philosopher Plato said that the physical world is kind of a grubby unreality, and the sooner we get rid of it, the better. The sooner we get to the world of ideas and spirit, the better. And Greek philosophy basically believed that, but Christianity never said that, because Christianity believed in a creator who made a good creation. And yes, the creation is fallen, but what does a good creator do with a fallen creation? He doesn't get rid of it. He renews it. He restores it. He brings it to fulfillment. Now, some of the other religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, also teach that you remove physicality. I mean, the whole point of Hinduism is not to keep coming back in a body, reincarnation. The whole point of Hinduism is to escape the body eventually, so that your spirit doesn't come back into this world of physicality. But the Jewish hope of the Old Testament and the New Testament hope is that God will not remove creation, but restore creation. One of my favorite New Testament passages is in Romans 8, where Paul actually says the creation itself longs to be liberated. Mm-hmm. Now, this doesn't say we wait to be liberated from the creation, which is Hinduism. It says the creation itself longs to be liberated from its bondage to decay, Paul goes on. In other words, yes, there's something really wrong in this physical world, but God's going to restore it. And the resurrection of the body of Jesus is kind of like the first deposit of God's great big payment for the whole of creation.
See, that probably answers my question. How on earth is this going to happen? I suppose literally, how does the new creation happen? But as you say, the resurrection of Jesus is a foretaste of that.
Yeah, I guess there are two ways of answering it. The first is, it worked out, you know, that God could create a creation, couldn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, we live in one.
Yes.
So God can create anything. And he created this universe out of nothing. But the thing is, what he will do with the whole of creation is renew, not replace, renew. Just as Jesus, the man Jesus, died in a body and was raised in a body. It was actually that body. There is no body in a Jerusalem tomb. Hmm. It's that body that has been not just resuscitated, that would be the wrong idea, it has been gloriously resurrected. And the New Testament says what happened to Jesus is going to happen to us, but also to the creation. The creation is going to be resurrected.
So this physical idea of a new creation is there in the Bible. It's also there in the history of the church, actually.
Ah, it sure is. I mean, this idea of us, you know, going and sitting on clouds playing harps is brand new. It's kind of Hollywood stuff, actually. It's brand new in the history of the church, because the ancient church, say in the Nicene Creed, those of you who go to sort of more mainstream churches who say that the Nicene Creed, says that what we look forward to is the resurrection of the dead. And I happen to know you were in church this morning, in a particular church, Lee, where we said the Athanasian Creed, which is the third great creed of the historic church. Mm. Roman Catholics say this, the Orthodox, but also Protestants, Anglicans, Lutherans, and so on. And at the end of that creed, it says, at Jesus' coming, all people shall rise bodily to give an account of their lives. Now, that's what the ancient church taught, that there's a bodily resurrection and a new creation.
Mm. Well, if that's where the Bible ends, in a way, as it began with that sense of, I think, promise and hope, here's a question. How's it going to impact on me in how I live? And I want to ask that question on behalf of those both with Christian faith, but also for the spectator who's been listening into this journey over the last couple of months.
Yeah, well, I think the Bible has lots of stuff to say to believer and spectator alike. Yeah. But if I can start with the believer, I guess the first thing I'd say is we who trust that God will restore all things know that this life is not all there is. I think that's the great hope. Our lifespan is not the full running length. Human injustice is going to find an answer in God's justice. And the groaning of this creation that we all experience is going to give way to the glories of God's new creation. So, in other words, we are people of great hope. Mm. And I know I've told you before, Lee, I can't remember whether I've shared with your guests about a friend, James, who recently passed away. And
yes.
I got to visit him quite a bit in the months before his death. But when he died, I was able to conduct his funeral and tell all of his lawyer and judge friends that James had really come to trust in the resurrection that Jesus promised. And I got to tell these friends of his at his funeral that I saw him just a few days before he died, and he was in a morphine stupor. So it wasn't great fun. It was sort of awful. But I said, James, it's John here. Do you want to pray? And his eyes lit up and he shot up his hand out outside the blankets and grabbed hold of my hand. And I prayed with him. And you could just tell he was just longing for God. But by the time I finished my prayer, he was back into his morphine stupor and gone. And then a couple of days later, he died. But there's a man who is now in the presence of God, who will know eternal life in a new creation. And this meant so much to him in those dying moments. And so I think this is actually one of the most practical things you could ever know, that this life is not all there is. God will restore it.
And James was a judge.
Yeah.
It's probably worth saying that with all due respect.
Yeah, and in fact, at his funeral, it was really interesting because speech after speech said, this man, James, was a man of impeccable judgment. They all spoke about what incredible judgment he had. So, of course, when I get up to give the sermon, I said, too right, he had good judgment. You should let me tell you what he thought of Jesus. So it was yes. kind of lovely. And he was a beautiful man, very measured, but came to a very deliberate faith. But this is not to say that it's only pie in the sky stuff. This is not just for dying people or anything like that. So Christianity, yes, it gives hope. But the way the New Testament thinks about this is that because there's a new kingdom coming, a new creation coming, that has a real impact on our life now. So I think of the Apostle Peter's words in 2 Peter 3. He says, in keeping with his promise, we are looking forward to a new heaven and a new earth where righteousness dwells. So then, dear friends, because you're looking forward to this, make every effort to be spotless, blameless, and at peace. Now, Peter isn't saying you better be good or you might not get into the kingdom. Yeah. He's saying there's a kingdom coming that is full of righteousness and peace. So why don't you live like it's here already? And the whole of Christian living is a bit like anticipating a new kingdom that we know is on the way. Hmm. We've heard the trumpets and it's coming over the horizon. So we live by the values of that kingdom now. We know the kingdom is going to bring justice to the world. So what do? We live for justice. We try and redress the problems of homelessness and poverty and so on that we're talking about tonight. We know that there's going to be a kingdom of love. So we love people now. So the Christian life is about practicing the future kingdom, living as if it's already here because man, oh man, it's on its way.
It's interesting in our Human Condition segment with Lynn Worsley a couple of weeks ago, we've been on this our pursuit of happiness for the last few weeks. And she said, from a completely different context, one of the key things from a psychologist's point of view to generate happiness and a sense of well-being is the question of hope. So that view beyond yourself, beyond your current circumstances, you got hope, you're likely to be happy.
And more than happy, you're able to have resilience in the presence. You're able to overcome the injustice. So I can't imagine how depressed I'd be as an aid worker trying to overcome poverty if I didn't think that ultimately there would be a world in which God would remove poverty. Mm. If I just thought it was my puny efforts with no ultimate resolution, I'd find it really hard.
Yeah. Again, you may have your questions for John Dixon, your comments on how the Bible hangs together or not. I can tell you he's up to anything you'd like to throw at him. You can talk to John. He's here in the studio, 1300 40 2020. Maybe you've been listening as a spectator to the Christian faith over these last couple of months and you think, maybe after all, and in spite of religion and the church, there is something in this. Where do I take it? What next? Where do I go? Ask John on 1300 40 2020. Hi, Julie.
Yes, I just wanted to know what the other evidence for Jesus was other than the historian Josephus and the Gospel.
Sure. Well, Josephus gives us two references to Jesus, and they're
Josephus,
both...
Josephus, sorry.
Yeah, Josephus. No worries. They're old names. They're all dead. He wouldn't be upset.
Or his family.
He gives us two references to Jesus. Both are really fascinating. But you're right to mention the Gospels, but we also have to mention Paul because Paul is independent of the Gospels. And if we treat the New Testament like historians do. They treat the Gospels as separate sources from Paul, and Paul gives us a stack of information about Jesus that he didn't get from the Gospels. So that's really significant. But then I guess what you're really asking is, what are some other non-Christian references? And these are outlined in plenty of books, some of which I've written, but I won't give them a plug. But Thallus, in the middle of the first century, refers to the darkness that coincided with the crucifixion of Jesus. He's a non-Christian writer.
Right.
We have Marabar Serapion in the 70s AD. He's a Stoic philosopher, and he mentions Jesus as a wise king whom the Jews killed. And then we have the greatest of ancient Rome's historians, Tacitus. Now, Tacitus is the one who gives us virtually everything we know about the emperors, you know, Emperor Tiberius, Caligula, Nero, all of that comes from Tacitus, pretty much all of it. And in one passage, he refers to Jesus and says that he went by the name Christ, and he was executed during the governorship of Pontius Pilate, and that the deadly superstition that started in his name made its way all the way to Rome. So Tacitus gives us pretty strong confirmation too, and he is another non-Christian. So that's about it. So there are enough non-Christian references for us to be, you know, more than confident, certain that Jesus lived.
Yes.
And given that, what historians then do is they turn to the New Testament. This is the interesting thing. Even non-Christian historians use the New Testament as the main source for Jesus, because they don't have that sort of silly, skeptical thing that you get a lot today that says, oh, if it's in the Bible, we can't trust it. New Testament historians, even non-Christian ones, say, you know what, sure, we don't treat the New Testament as the Word of God, but it's a human document from the first century, written pretty close in time to Jesus. We better listen to it. And so they do listen to it.
Julie, thanks so much for your call.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us on Open House. And if you'd like to join us, 1-300-40-2020 is the number. Francisca from Blacktown has called in. Hi, Francisca.
Hi, how are you?
Thanks very much for calling in. Fine, thanks. Here's John.
All right, thank you.
G'day, Francisca. What's your question?
My question is pretty much, will the new Earth will be in heaven or on Earth?
Yeah, that's a great question. The great way the New Testament describes it is that heaven and earth come together. So if you were to open up Revelation chapter 21, which is the passage to read, it basically says God creates new heaven and new earth, and then the new Jerusalem comes down out of heaven onto earth and glorifies earth. And that's where God and humanity in a renewed earth dwell forever. So what's happening there?
I was actually leaning towards that answer.
Yeah, well, you're right. You go with your intuition.
Top marks.
The realities of heaven come to earth to renew it. That's the way to think about it.
Yeah, because a lot of people, they're very confused about the topic. Like, some are saying it's just we all go to heaven. Some are saying we're on earth. And
yeah, just stick with Revelation 21.
All right.
Francisca. So
the main chapter is 21, is it?
Revelation 21. But if you want some Old Testament background reading, Isaiah 65, from verse 17 forward, says the same thing.
Okay.
Funny about that.
Yeah. Thanks very much for that.
Pleasure.
Francisca, thanks very much for calling in. Good on you. John, finally, I want to ask one specific question. What would you leave the spectator with? I think one reason I've been so grateful to have had you take us through this whole series is that you come at, as I said before, not just theologically or theoretically, but historically. And I think that's something that has the potential to resonate with both Christian and spectator alike.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is that the Bible answers our deepest longings, our longing for knowing God, our longing to get along with each other, and our longing for the physical realities of our existence to be resolved. So the Bible satisfies the deepest human longings. And I know that some people cynically, skeptically say, ah, well, the Bible is just a wish fulfillment then, you know?
Yep.
Humans have longed for these things from, you know, centuries past, and so they invented stories in the Bible to satisfy those longings. And some people say this so often it almost sounds, you know, true. But it actually came into our culture. We can actually date this. In the 1840s, where there was a German philosopher, Ludwig Feuerbach. You can Google him if you like. But Ludwig basically said that religion is a wish fulfillment. We wish for these things to be true, and all of a sudden we start finding ourselves believing them. Sigmund Freud said the same thing. You long for a big daddy in the sky, and so you imagine that he's there. But people cheekily asked those guys at the time. So what does that make your atheism?
Good point.
Yeah. So well, why isn't your atheism just a wish fulfillment too? You don't want there to be a God, so you imagine that there isn't one. So, you know, the wish fulfillment idea doesn't really work. I mean, the fact that humanity has longings that are satisfied by the teaching of the Bible is no more an argument against the Bible than my physical thirst is an argument against this drink I have in front of me.
Yeah.
You know, I long for this drink because I've got a bit of a sore throat. Now, the fact that I have a longing for this drink doesn't mean the drink isn't real.
That's a good point, yeah.
So I sort of say, yes, humans have these longings for God, for each other, and for the creation. And here's the thing, the Bible fulfills them. It doesn't mean the Bible isn't true, because if the Bible were true, if God had created us for himself, what else would you expect that we would long for him? And it was the great St. Augustine who years ago said these words. They're centuries old, but listen to them. He said, "Man is one of your creatures, Lord. His instinct is to praise you. You made us for yourself, and our hearts find no peace until they rest in you." In other words, everything that the Bible has on offer is actually on offer because the one who makes the offer made us for himself. So we're not meant to live apart from him, not meant to live apart from one another, not meant to live in this kind of real discord with the creation. So for me, the real question is Christianity true? You know?
Yeah.
You know, there's no question.
Good question.
There's no question that it satisfies our longings. It really does. The question is Jesus really H2O to my thirst? And I reckon when you ask that question, you've stepped very much into Christian territory and out of skeptical territory, because first there's the miracle of the Bible itself. The fact that so many authors from so many different cultures over so long a period came up with such a coherent, beautiful, linear story, I think is a sheer miracle. And then there's the actual historical evidence that we've already touched on tonight for Jesus. That evidence points very awkwardly in the direction of Jesus actually living, teaching, healing, dying, and rising again. So I reckon there's a resurrection-shaped dent in the historical record that points to Christianity not just being a wish fulfillment, but being a true wish fulfillment. I fully admit, yes, it's spooky. Christianity does satisfy the deepest human longings, but that's because it's true and has come from the God for whom we are made. So for me, it's fitting that one of the last lines of the Bible issues a beautiful invitation, and it goes like this. It's from Revelation 22. "Let the one who is thirsty come, and let the one who wishes take the free gift of the water of life." See, there's a free admission that the Bible is like water to a thirst. But it's also saying it's a free gift. It's on offer. And God longs to restore your relationship with him, with each other, and ultimately with the creation. And the key is taking hold of the gift that we have through Jesus.
And if there's one tonight listening who is thirsty, who recognises that need, who desires the hope, what would you say to them?
You know, I remember meeting this woman in Bath in England recently. And she told me she'd been circling Christianity for ages and never landed. And I said, you know, why? And we talked for a little bit. She told me a little about her life. She'd had this question, that question, and always just skirted around Christianity, but was intrigued. And in the end, I looked at her and I said, look, you've told me a little about your life. Can I just ask you this? Do you have any good reason not to follow Christ? And she stopped and she said, I'll never forget her words. She said, I have lots of practical reasons.
That's a funny answer. Yeah.
But she said, none of them good. Uh-huh. And I thought, wow. And so I guess I'd say to, you know, anyone who's pondering Christianity, are your reasons good for not landing, for not taking hold of the free gift that the Bible offers everyone? Sort out your own motives, your own situation, but in the end, make some little approach to God. Make some step in the right direction. I have another mate who is the kind of person who always has to cross every T and dot every I before he makes any move.
Fair enough, yeah.
And it's sort of okay. He's a statistician, and statisticians need to do that, right?
Yes.
But I said to him, look, you've been looking into Christianity for years. Why haven't you done anything? And he said, oh, I need to cross every T, dot every I. Every doubt needs to be answered before I make any move. And I said, mate, what if you ever applied that to relationships? You know, needing to know everything about a person before you make any step toward them. And he said, oh, yeah, I've done that a couple of times.
Yeah, sure.
That didn't go so well. And I said, well, Christianity is more like a relationship than a mathematical formula.
And admittedly, an exercise of faith.
It is.
Unashamedly.
But so are all relationships.
Sure.
See, when you get to know someone, how do you do it? You don't wear your heart on your sleeve on your first meeting with someone. You give a little bit of yourself, you see what comes back. And if something comes back that's really positive, you give a little more of yourself and something comes back. And before you know it, you've got a relationship. Well, becoming a Christian's like that. So, you know, people may be listening to us thinking, yeah, I think there's probably a God. There's something in that whole Jesus thing. Well, I'd say, don't wait till you've answered every question before you start praying. Before you start saying, God, if you're there, show me. I really want to do it. If you really think that Jesus has some connection with God, don't try and answer every question before you do anything about it. Start reading a gospel. Pick up the Gospel of Luke. Read the life of Jesus, because there you get front row seats to the life of God on earth. But I think ultimately, if you're sitting there thinking, you know, maybe God has got this water of life for me and I'm thirsty, I need a relationship with God, I need to be forgiven, I'm pretty sure Jesus did die and rise again, you may still have other doubts, but let them settle along the road somewhere. For now, just make little steps in the right direction and say, God, I reckon you're probably there. I need you. I want you. I want to be in connection with you. Will you please come into my life? Just make that step and then just see what comes back, and then a relationship will blossom.
And here the series ends. John Dixon, from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for being with us in our first 8 weeks of Open House with what's been the most wonderful series. You have given us so much of your gifts and your time. So thank you so much. It's been a great journey.
Absolute pleasure.
Good on you, mate. See you soon. And if you've missed any one of our chats over these past 2 months in our Spectator's Guide to the Bible, or if you want to get the whole of the series, you can listen to or download the MP3s on our Open House website, openhousecommunity.com.au. I've said before, I reckon this series would make a great Bible study, quite literally, or a book club series. Certainly don't have to be a Christian to read the Bible. Download them all and work through them with your friends. And just one more thing. If you are tonight thinking through all this, what John's had to say, maybe considering your next step in it all, or considering taking that step to say, yep, seems to add up enough for me. I'd like to have this. I reckon I might need it. Have a listen to New World Sun. There is a way.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit openhouseonline.com.au.